And now, more tips with your host, Rebecca, on lifestyle improvement.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and is not to be interpreted as medical advice.
Thank you for tuning in today to Lifestyle Improvement for part two of our interview with Dr. Barry Prezant. Dr. Prezant is recognized as one of the leading scholars in autism spectrum disorders and has more than 40 years' experience as a clinical scholar, a researcher, and a consultant for persons with related disabilities and their families. He is also the author of the book Uniquely Human, a different way of seeing autism that is challenging many to rethink how this condition has been understood.
Well, we believe that for any person, quality of life is often based upon social communication, which also includes developing caring relationships with others, developing trust with others. It's those relationships. I mentioned the emotional regulation and the transactional support. So if you are at the end of your life and you're reflecting on your life, you think about your relationships, you think about those times that you've been able to be with people and you had that ease of communication and connection. You think about the stresses and the times you felt really good when you were well regulated emotionally. And you think about all the wonderful supports that you've had in your life, maybe a job you loved, all the people you've loved. So we believe this is quality of life for everybody.
Absolutely. And I am so glad you mentioned the word trust, because you do talk about trust in your book in depth. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Yes, and let me give credit where credit's due. One autistic man who I met a number of years ago, and we're very good personal friends now, his name is Michael John Carley. And I discuss him in the book. He's one of the experts, when I talk about the real experts. And Michael and I have written together. We've presented together. We're in touch all the time. I just saw him a few weeks ago with his family. Michael has a diagnosis of Asperger's. He was diagnosed as an adult, and he has a son with Asperger's. Okay, the long intro is because Michael asked me to read an unpublished manuscript for a book. It was probably a year and a half, 2 years ago. And there was a quote in the book. And the quote was, "The opposite of anxiety is not calm. The opposite of anxiety is trust." And that triggered all these thoughts in my mind about how autistic people have difficulty trusting other people because they have difficulty understanding other people. Okay. As a matter of fact, let me give you an example. Last night, for the first time, I saw the movie The Imitation Game about Alan Turing, who was one of the people who broke the Nazi code that helped us turn the war around in World War II. Definitely a man with Asperger's. And he spoke about how he had difficulty understanding people in the movie, amazing movie, and how people never really said what they meant to say because we use all these metaphors and idioms. How could you trust somebody who doesn't talk plain to you? And it's difficult to understand, okay? So trusting people is difficult for people with autism due to their neurologically based condition. Trusting their bodies in the sense of the sensory world, for example. As I've alluded to, many people on the autism spectrum are very hypersensitive to stimulation. Sound is painful, okay? Touch could be painful. In some cases, they're undersensitive. Okay, so they have problems processing the world. But the other thing I think about a lot is, what about people with autism who have less understanding of language? If you're sick, if we know we're sick, we know that cold will pass. We have previous experience. If we fall down and cut our knee, you know, okay, it's painful at the time, but people take care of us. We know it'll be okay. If you're a person who has a disability that doesn't allow you to understand what people are saying to you, and if you have a stomach virus and you have that awful, painful feeling in your stomach, how can you trust your body? And we do know that autistic people have more related physiological issues than typical people of the same age, such as gastrointestinal issues, such as the sensory issues. So, as a matter of fact, there is a literature that looks at people with chronic illnesses, such as cancer. And these are neurotypical people. And they say, I can't trust my body anymore. My body's doing things to me, and it's reacting in ways it never did. So what's that like in life if you can't trust your body? And then finally, trusting the world. We really trust and hope that our routines, our schedules in life are somewhat consistent. We have all these coping strategies. If our daily schedule changes or something happens, let's say to a friend of ours, they break a leg, they have to go to the hospital. Life is very unpredictable, okay? We know that autistic people crave predictability because they have so many challenges in life. We all crave predictability when we face challenges in life. When things are consistent, when we can anticipate and predict what's going to happen, it helps us feel very grounded. When routines change, appointments are canceled, a hurricane, I live on the East Coast, a hurricane prevents us from getting on our flight to Florida, it makes us very dysregulated. So getting back to your original question, in many ways, I think it's helpful to think about autism as a disability of trust. And we have to help autistic people to be better able to trust their bodies, to be better able to trust us, which means we have to be more predictable. We have to communicate more clearly, and also to be able to trust the world by helping them to understand the routines in life. And that's why we use a lot of strategies like visual schedule for autistic children to help them understand and see, not just understand, but see how their life proceeds during a typical day.
Absolutely. That's so well said. And a couple of things come to mind as I hear you speaking. One of them were when you said grounded, because I think about when you're grounded, it's like a boat that has, you know, that has a strong fulcrum in the bottom and is stable. And when you are grounded and stable and you're on that boat, you feel safe. So what I hear is a feeling of safety that you have when you know that you are grounded, that you know where you are. And a lot of these kids or adult don't have that sense like you just elaborated on, correct?
That's absolutely correct. As a matter of fact, during some presentations, I use a slide, and it's the quotes from Aeschylus from about 2,000 years ago. And the quote is something like, I am not afraid of stormy seas because I've learned how to sail my boat in life. So a number of the things you mentioned keep us grounded, but at the same time, we have to have the strategies to deal with the stormy seas of life and get through.
That is so well said, and I think that it makes sense to a lot of the listeners that have family members that are struggling with this because, like you said, they also are dealing with those changes as well.
That's right. And just to follow up on that metaphor, I think it's very fair to say, and we would all agree with this, that children with autism, autistic people, have more stormy seas potentially than we have. And certainly it's not just a problem for that person. It changes the whole dynamic, the culture, the mode of operating for the family, because parents are always having to anticipate, when will these difficulties happen? Now, technically, we refer to those as high-risk situations. What situations put a person with autism in high risk? And it's unpredictable environments, it's noisy environments, it's people who may get in their face and touch them too much. We have a whole chapter in Uniquely Human on people who get it. And I borrowed actually an analogy from a parent, which he calls the it factor. And the it factor is that some people just know how to support and be with an autistic person. They read their signals well, they know how to anticipate difficulties, and they support them well. Then there are people on the other end who are it-less, that they cause more problems. They actually cause more stress for people with autism, maybe because they use discipline too much without understanding that person's experience. They talk too loudly at them, whatever. And then in the middle is what we call the it-like people. And the it-like people are those who have good intentions, let's say a new teacher or a new neighbor, and they have good intentions, they want to be helpful, but it doesn't come naturally to them. So they say to us, you know, I really like your son. He seems like a nice man, but I've never really been with a child with autism before. Can you help me out so that I can connect with your son better? And that's been very useful, especially in educational settings, because even with teachers and therapists, sometimes you see the got it people. Sometimes you see the it-like people and sometimes you see the it-less people.
I am so glad you brought that up, because one of the big points that I saw you mention was the matter of empathy.
Absolutely. And I would say this is one of the most difficult but important things for people to do when you have an autistic person in your life or you work in a situation just to get to know them or support them. And that is, can you try your best to understand what their experience is?
This is your host, Rebecca. And now we will take a short break, and we will be right back with more ideas on lifestyle improvement.
A unique and specialized approach to spinal care is what you will find in the Advanced Spinal Care Clinic in Graham, Washington. Here's Dr. Craig Lipinski explaining why Nuke Care is unlike any other treatment.
Our goal is that we're making a specialized correction to the skull, the atlas, and the neck of each individual that is custom made or custom and specific created to get them healthy and then have them stay that way.
One of only 23 board certified Nuke practitioners in the world, Dr. Craig Lipinski offers you care that can significantly impact your health in positive ways.
This week we've seen somebody in here who's had a 50-point drop in blood pressure by having the skull, atlas, and neck corrected to a proper position.
To find out more about how Nuka Care can change your life, visit www.nuccawashington.com or call 253-445-8181.
I am so glad you brought that up, because one of the big points that I saw you mention was the matter of empathy.
Absolutely. And I would say this is one of the most difficult but important things for people to do when you have an autistic person in your life or you work in a situation just to get to know them or support them. And that is, can you try your best to understand what their experience is? Rather than just labeling the behavior as good or bad, can we understand that, you know, when that child gets his look in his eyes, it's not that he's just being uncooperative, it's that he's feeling a high degree of fear. And what is it then that might be causing that fear for him or that anxiety for her? So that notion of empathy has to do with, can we get to know a person so well that by reading their signals and having shared experiences in life with them, that not only can we anticipate what's difficult for them, but we could empathize and say, I understand why you're having such a difficult time, or you're so worried, or why you're screaming now, because I could try, you know, my best educated guess is I think you're feeling this right now, and I need to be respectful and sensitive to what you're feeling. And for many, many years, approaches in autism have not allowed us to do that, where we could just look at the behavior on the surface. And literally, there have been approaches, what we call traditional behavioral approaches, where you're not even allowed to think about what that person is thinking. That no, you can't. You could just look at the behavior and deal with the behavior. But that goes against what we do every day as human beings. We are always interpreting another person's feelings. We are always trying to make sense of their perspective and how they see the world. And that's what connectedness is, and that's what trust is built upon.
Thank you. Thank you so much for elaborating on that. Now, how about the subject of enthusiasm? How does that work into the program?
Yeah, and this also, let me give credit to a lot of people now. This is part of the big sea change that's happening in autism, that enthusiasms have to do with a person's passions. What lights their fire? What do they get excited about? And therefore, what do they focus their attention on? What could they stay with for long periods? So part of this depathologizing, as I call it, depathologizing autism and autistic behavior is getting away from the notion of, oh, that's just an obsession. The notion of obsession has somewhat of a negative connotation, okay? But the term enthusiasm, which was coined by one of the, literally one of the mothers who was one of the most important parent advocates in the history of autism. Her name is Clara Claiborne Park. Clara passed away. I knew Clara well. She passed away about 4 years ago at 84 years of age. First parent to write a book about raising a child with autism. It was called The Siege. And her daughter, Jessie, is now 55, I believe mid-50s. And she's a great artist because her parents took advantage of and supported her and saw her enthusiasms in life. So it has to do with looking at a person's strengths and interests and utilizing those strengths and interests in education, in developing relationships with others, like special interest groups. So some kids are incredible with Legos, constructing Lego buildings. And so put the kid in a Lego club, okay? What's really interesting is sometimes enthusiasms are not quite mainstream or what we call conventional. Some are, like trains, okay? So many kids with autism just love Thomas the Tank Engine and trains. And by the way, I could tell you a wonderful story. We tell it in the book about a youngster with autism in Chicago, grew up with a single mom in poverty and was always absolutely enthusiastic about trains. But he was so enthusiastic about trains and wanted to just play with his trains all the time that some professionals told his mother, you got to put those away. It's getting in the way. And his mother said, no, I'm creative with it. And it's an important part of his joy in life. Well, in his 20s now, that young man now works for the Chicago Transit Authority. And he works in the routing office, and he's a valued employee because of that. So the whole notion of enthusiasms is not only when a child is young, but as they go through school, and now even more so, as they leave school and have the potential to go into job situations. How can we not only honor, but how can we help that person connect that enthusiasm to things that are valued by society and that may lead to a life vocation or at least a hobby? And this is a huge turnaround in the field of autism over the last few years.
Can enthusiasm ever become an issue?
Yeah. In some cases, if a person has an enthusiasm that causes them to behave in ways that are not very helpful. So, for example, I've known kids who just loved looking at different kinds of microwave ovens. And one of these kids would walk around the neighborhood and walk into people's houses to see what kind of microwave oven they had in the house without permission. That caused problems, okay? If an enthusiasm, it is so intense that a person or a child basically doesn't want to do anything else, so, you know, will not be able to go along with school routine because they always just want to do one thing in school, that could be problematic. So one of the great goals for autistic people is to help them be more flexible and develop varied interests, but at the same time still honor their enthusiasm and connect their enthusiasm to other things in life for them.
And as you are doing that, I'm sure it takes a lot of, like you said, flexibility because you're sharing that control back and forth, right?
That's right. And that's a term we use in the book that's been used in the field of disabilities for a number of years, shared control. That if you have choice in life and you are able to do things that you love, even though it's not 100% of the time, but you say, well, wait a second, you know, you could play with your trains you could choose to play with your trains and let's do that for a while. But then, you know, then we're going to practice putting your shoes on so we can go outside. So this notion of sometimes mom or dad or Barry gets to choose, but sometimes you get to choose. And by the way, having choice in life is another way to stay well-regulated emotionally. When people just impose things on you and say you need to do this and you have no say, you know, either you become depressed, despondent, or you go the other way. You protest and you fight back and you push back. And unfortunately, we see both patterns in many autistic people. Depression is very, very common, especially on into the teenage years and adult years. And then some kids have such strong wills and spirits is that they fight back. You can't just keep telling me what to do. This stresses me out. This is too difficult for me. I want to have more choice in my life. So as part of our approach in the CERTS model is we try to offer choice whenever feasible and appropriate. And also at the same time, teach that sometimes you don't have a choice.
Correct. Like, for example, if you are in a large institution like school, that's a place where there's a lot of challenge as far as making that happen, correct?
That's correct. As a matter of fact, school can be one of the most challenging arenas because it's so intensely social. And of course, one of the characteristics for many autistic people is social anxiety. As you move on beyond the elementary years, you're changing classes rapidly. Those kinds of transitions are very, very difficult for autistic people. And there are rules that are imposed upon you that you may not agree with or might not understand, but you're asked to accept them anyway. I could go through a list of probably 10 to 15 reasons why school is a hotbed of stress for children on the spectrum.
And I think that would be very obvious for parents that have to deal with the results of it once they come back home after they're in school all day, or teachers that have to deal with it through the day. But I like the fact that you talk about the shared control, because that is one piece that I think could make a difference as far as how a day goes in a school, for example.
In my school consulting, when I see a situation where a student is being quote unquote non-compliant or not cooperative, not going along with the agenda, what I often find is that student doesn't have a lot of say in their lives. And that's one of the strategies that I recommend right up front that is very, very helpful.
Perfect. Thank you. So in your book, you also talk about emotional memory. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. Emotional memory, something we all know well. When we think about memory, we typically think about factual memory. So I want to make a contrast. You know, so what's the address of that house? And that house is a beautifully painted red house. So they have beautiful antique furniture in the house. So much of life we think of in terms of facts. But what we also do is we put an emotional tag on an experience. So it could be a memory about a person. It could be a memory about a place like that house I just mentioned. It could be a memory about an activity like playing a sport. So emotional memory is the feeling that we associate with that person, place, or activity. So what is human nature about this? Human nature is all about that we seek out things for which we have positive emotional memories. So people who make us feel good, activities that make us feel competent, environments that we feel comfortable in, we seek out. What's the reverse of that? What we call negative emotional memory. We avoid people who stress us out. We choose not to do activities that we know we're not very good at. So I'm not good at particular sports, for example. I was never good at basketball, even though I grew up in New York City and was in schoolyards where kids were playing basketball all the time. I didn't volunteer to be on a team. You know, I would play something else. And we avoid people who stress us out. There are two factors that are relevant for autistic people. Number one, a strength that's been demonstrated year after year in research is a strength in rote memory. Excellent memories. And as I mentioned earlier, people in general on the spectrum have more stresses in life due to many of the factors that I've discussed. So if you have a very strong memory and you have more stress, there are more things that are going to cause stress. Now, here's the kicker. Here's the point. You don't necessarily have to be experiencing that stress directly. It is just the memory of that stress. So if I say to you, you know, you should go to the dentist. I know you have a cavity, but that should be taken care of. So you should go to the dentist tomorrow. You might start feeling anxious. You might start feeling worried. And it has to do with your memory of having a cavity taken care of in the past. Same thing with people. I always like to give this example. You go to a high school reunion and you see all these faces. You may not remember the names or what classes those people were in, but you will remember typically whether you liked that person or whether you did not like that person. So a lot of what guides us in life has to do with our positive and negative emotional memories. And we go along with the agenda, or we refuse to go along with the agenda by avoiding activities, places, or people based upon our emotional memory. We feel that in many cases, autistic people are at the mercy of their emotional memory. We can reason through it. But unfortunately, for many autistic people, they experience that emotion in a very raw way. They don't have the insulation around the wire. And so just seeing a person who has caused a great deal of stress might result in a student bolting out of the room. Let me give you a quick example. A young man I knew had a babysitter named Jennifer, and we discussed this in the book. And we didn't know this at the time, and mom didn't know this, but Jennifer had actually physically abused this child when this child was a baby. 10 years later, the child was getting a new aide to work with him in school. and the aide's name was Jennifer. And so this student was told, oh, you're going to get a new aide, her name is Jennifer. And this student started screaming, no, Jennifer, no, Jennifer, no, Jennifer, because he had remembered what happened with that other Jennifer. So it's a very scary situation. Yeah, so we have to help kids deal with emotional memories and, on the other hand, build positive emotional memories.
And how would you teach positive emotional memories?
Well, one of the things that we want to do very often is use visual supports, because very often a lot of people with autism, not all, but most, learn better through visual means. So we literally could sit down and, through visual means, begin to develop categories of things I love to do or things that are more difficult for me to do. And maybe with things that are more difficult for me to do, what can we do to make it less difficult? How can we support you better? Just helping by modeling that language. So very often a child with autism might have great enthusiasms and love some things, but may not have the words to say that.
And remember that in our program, we present our opinion and the opinion of our guest, and it's not to be interpreted as medical advice.
Thank you for tuning in today to Lifestyle Improvement for part two of our interview with Dr. Barry Prezant. Dr. Prezant is recognized as one of the leading scholars in autism spectrum disorders and has more than 40 years' experience as a clinical scholar, a researcher, and a consultant for persons with related disabilities and their families. He is also the author of the book Uniquely Human, a different way of seeing autism that is challenging many to rethink how this condition has been understood. Thanks again for joining us today here on Lifestyle Improvement. And don't forget to join us again next Sunday morning from 7:30 to 8 for part 3 of our interview with Dr. Barry Prezant.